Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Employment Matters podcast, brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the world. I'm your host, Holly Goodman, shareholder with Gunster in Southern Florida. On the program, we span the globe and receive updates on critical issues from ELA members in each region. On today's episode, we'll be discussing guidance that the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division recently issued regarding remote workers. Joining us on the program are Megan Mitchell and Lindsay Locke, partner and associate at Arnall Golden Gregory LLP in Georgia. Megan and Lindsay, welcome. We are just absolutely delighted to have you on the program today to talk about this new and emerging issue. Thank you for joining us. How are you?
We're good, Holly. Thank you so much for having us.
So we're here today to discuss the Department of Labor's recent guidance relating to remote workers. Megan, what can you tell us about the DOL's recent update?
So, Holly, the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division issues what's called field assistance bulletins, which you're probably familiar with. So field assistance bulletins are guidance for DOL investigators and staff to use, and they explain the DOL's position on certain topics. So they're also helpful for employers. The guidance that we'll be discussing today is related to the Fair Labor Standards Act, or the FLSA, and the Family and Medical Leave Act, or the FMLA. The FLSA governs payment of wages. It's applicable to most U.S. employers. And the FMLA sets forth the requirements for unpaid leave time for certain covered employees in certain qualifying situations. The guidance that we'll be discussing today addresses certain requirements of these two laws as applied to remote workers. Of course, in today's post-pandemic world, remote work is really universal. So the guidance provides some answers to questions that employers may have about how to comply with the FMLA and the FLSA when it comes to remote workers.
Thank you for that overview, Megan. As I understand it, this new field assistant bulletin that the DOL just put out covers basically three main topics. I'd like to break down each one of them for our listeners here. Lindsay, I think the first issue relates to determining when or whether a remote employee qualifies under the FMLA. What can you tell us about the DOL's position?
Yeah, sure. And that's right, Holly. The primary FMLA related issue addressed by the bulletin is how to determine whether a remote worker qualifies for FMLA leave. So as I'm sure everybody listening to this is probably aware, there's kind of a multiple layer analysis on determining FMLA eligibility. First, you have to determine whether the employer is even covered by the FMLA. And then you have to analyze whether the individual employee is eligible for that FMLA leave. The new guidance addresses the latter issue. So by way of background, in order to be eligible for FMLA leave, an employee must meet three main requirements. First, they must have worked for the employer for at least 12 months. Second, they must have worked at least 1,250 hours in those previous 12 months. And finally, they must work at a location of the employer where they have at least 50 employees within 75 miles. Now, most of these things are pretty easy to apply. Doesn't matter if somebody works remotely or in office. If you've worked for 12 months, you've worked for 12 months. But the issue that kind of is affected by remote working is that last issue. So if you have a fully remote workforce, somebody who works from their home every day of the week, they never go into an office, how do you determine what work location they work at for purposes of that last kind of geographic factor? So this is where the Department of Labor has kind of come in and give some guidance with this new field bulletin. So they've stated that for purposes of FMLA eligibility, and remote employee's work location is the office that they either report to or where they receive their work assignments from. So just to kind of give a little example of this, let's say that we have a company headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia. That's their only physical office. And they have 30 employees that physically report to that office on an almost daily basis. You know, their accounting team, their HR team, you know, you name it, their management. But they also have a sales team of 25 individuals who work remotely from all over the country. They're in California, they're in Michigan, they're in New York, whatever the case may be. But they all receive their work assignments directly from management from that Atlanta office. So for purposes of FMLA eligibility, all 25 of those people on the sales team would report to the Atlanta office, even though they may never physically step foot in it. They probably only came for orientation. But for FMLA purposes, they are considered to work at that office because that's where they receive their assignments from. So if that office has at least 50 employees reporting to it, including both the remote employees and those that physically come in every day, then that would meet at least that factor of the FMLA analysis. So for purposes of our example, we have 30 in-office employees, 25 remote employees, all reporting to the same location. So in that instance, assuming the other factors are met, those remote employees would all qualify for FMLA leave.
Thank you, Lindsay. This is an important clarification from the Department of Labor for those remote workers to ensure that they have the same rights as in-office employees. It's really helpful that the DOL is giving this guidance to clarify how each of these laws apply to remote workers, just as they do to those who are working in the office. And on that subject, I believe that the Field Assistance Bulletin also addresses compensation surrounding breaks for remote workers. Megan, what does the DOL Field Assistance Bulletin say for the FLSA break time?
Yes, Holly. So in kind of the trend that we're seeing with the Department of Labor to want to establish broader coverage for these two laws with respect to the FLSA, which is the law that addresses break time. The new guidance addresses how to calculate hours worked in the context of breaks for remote employees. So the FLSA requires payments for hours worked, in quotes. And it sounds like hours worked might be something that's easy to calculate, but it's really not. It's a difficult question for a lot of employers, especially when you're dealing with remote employees. Historically, and I should note too, this guidance doesn't really change the law in any major way. It just gives us some more examples to use with remote workers. So the principles that employers may have been familiar with when it comes to dealing with break time and hours worked, those principles will still apply. And what the guidance is really doing is confirming that those principles apply equally to remote workers, but monitoring enforcement is the real challenge. So the FLSA has historically had distinctions between short breaks and long breaks. So short breaks are breaks taken during the employee's workday that are typically 20 minutes or less as the touchstone for that short break. These breaks of 20 minutes or less are typically counted as hours worked for employees. And we won't go into exempt versus non-exempt for purposes of this podcast, but we are looking at non-exempt workers in this scenario. So if an employee is in the office or remote, if the employee takes any sort of break that's 20 minutes or less, whether that's a short stretch break for a remote worker, that may be a walk around the block with their dog, whatever that break is that's short in duration during the employee's workday, it should still be counted as hours worked for that employee. The new guidance makes that clear. Now, when it comes to longer breaks, the new guidance also makes clear that remote employees must be completely relieved from duty and able to effectively use the time for their own purposes. And these are terms that we find in the FLSA guidance, in order for the employer not to count the time as hours worked. So in one of the examples given in the guidance, say an employee works from home and has the flexibility to set their own schedule. This employee starts work at 7 a.m., takes a 1 hour break from 8 to 9 a.m. to get his or her children ready for school, and then resumes work at 9 a.m. The guidance makes clear that the period between 8 and 9 a.m. is not work time under the FLSA because the employee is completely relieved from duty, chooses when to resume work, and is able to effectively use the time for their own purposes. But in another example contained in the guidance, if during that 8 to 9 a.m. timeframe, when the employee is supposed to be getting their children ready for school, the employee is, for example, interrupted by work calls or answers work emails that may come in during that timeframe, in that scenario, the employee would not be completely relieved from duty and may need to be paid for that time accordingly. So the key takeaway here is that employers should take steps to ensure that their remote employees understand what needs to happen or not happen during their longer breaks, that are those breaks that are more than 20 minutes. So employers should think about giving their employees specific instructions that employees should not take calls or answer emails during these breaks. Those are just some examples. These are things that should be memorialized in an employer's handbook or some other type of policy and procedure document. But it's important to have these types of conversations early and often with your remote employees so that they are not performing work during times that they are on an actual break and not being paid for that time. It's a difficult problem for employers, and we see this a lot.
It is, I think, an issue that a lot of employers grapple with, the idea of the coffee break or employees who take a little bit longer on a break, but not quite up to that 20 minutes. I think with remote workers, especially someone who's changing out the laundry or maybe taking a few minutes to unload the dishwasher, employers see that and think, why do I need to pay them for that time? And the answer is it's no different than when they're at the office and they take that coffee break or when they take a few minutes to stretch. So I think it is really important for employers to remember here that this is not a change to the law. The legal principles are the same. It's just additional guidance, I think, to help us all understand how these same principles might apply in a work from home context.
Exactly.
I think the final topic that was addressed by the guidance relates to breaks for employees who are nursing. This has been a hot topic in this legislative session as well. I know that we've seen quite a bit of movement when it comes to nursing mothers and their rights in the workforce. So Lindsay, what is it that the Department of Labor has put out in this field guidance, this field assistance bulletin?
Sure, Holly. And this is kind of similar to the FLSA break guidance that Megan just described. You know, this is not a change in the law. This is just kind of meant to clarify and ensure that those who are working remotely are kind of getting the same benefits that those who work in the office are. So under the FLSA, employees who recently gave birth, so within the last year, and are nursing are entitled to certain breaks, to express breast milk, to pump, you know, in everyday parlance. And they're entitled to do that in a place where they're shielded from view from others for obvious reasons. And so this doesn't seem like it would be a huge issue, you know, when somebody's at home, they're generally alone or with their families, but this can come and present concerns for remote employees who, you know, either they're on a million Zoom calls a day and the expectation is that they're supposed to have their camera on at all times, or are otherwise subject to, you know, kind of some of this video monitoring that become more popular as more people work remotely and employers are trying to make sure that their employees are actually, you know, working when they're supposed to be working. So along those lines, these individuals must be given an opportunity to nurse and to pump without their cameras on, right? They must be allowed to turn a camera off for a Zoom meeting or shut off that video monitoring if that's at place. Employers need to make sure that they're giving employees privacy to do that. And additionally, the kind of same break rules that Megan just described, the short break versus the long break, whether or not the individual is completely relieved of their duties or not, also apply here. So if you have an employee who's taking a short 15-minute break to pump, they're entirely paid for that. If you have an employee who's taking a longer break, but they're also sitting on a Zoom meeting with their camera off, so they're technically still working, they're entitled to be paid for that. But on the flip side, if they do completely disengage from their laptop, go in another room, they're not answering calls, they're not checking their email, then of course they don't have to be paid for that time. Again, assuming we're talking about non-exempt employees. So it's kind of the same thing that Megan just mentioned. Employers just need to make sure that they have systems in place to monitor this, kind of know what their employees are doing, explain what the expectations are. You know, if you're going to pump and you're going to take 30 minutes, don't check your email, don't answer a work call. Just make sure those policies are up to date for how to address this with remote workers who aren't physically sitting in the office. You know, you can't see what they're doing. They get up from their desk, go take a longer break. It just becomes more difficult to monitor. And actually, the Department of Labor has issued some additional guidance since we first wrote an alert on this related to nursing employees. And so I think Megan's going to address the new guidance that's more recent.
So Lindsay, yes, I'll jump in and just add, because we could probably have a whole nother podcast solely on this topic, but the DOL did issue another field assistance bulletin on May 17th that addresses the PUMP Act and its break time requirements, whether the employee must be paid for time spent pumping, the privacy and functionality requirements of the pumping spaces that are required at offices, and the guidance also addresses exemptions to these requirements. And it's important to note here that the guidance does have an undue hardship type of exemption for small employers, meaning employers with fewer than 50 employees, but those employers can only claim an exemption if compliance would pose an undue hardship. And the DOL has made clear that this exemption will only apply in limited circumstances. So we expect to see increased attention and monitoring and enforcement of the protections that are available for nursing mothers in the workplace. We'll be monitoring that issue.
Well, thank you, Megan and Lindsay. That is all the time that we have today, but this has been a very interesting discussion and we really appreciate your time. It was a pleasure speaking with the both of you.
You too, Holly. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. If you would like to connect with Megan or Lindsay, please click on their bios in the description of this podcast. We also encourage you to reach out to any of our lawyers around the world by selecting Find a Lawyer on the ELA website at ela.law. In addition, search the ELA website where you can sign up to receive invitations to our upcoming webinars, download white papers and on-demand content from our online library, or access the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Holly Goodman. Thanks for listening.